November Dropping. Here we are.
Let's stay where you are. No,
so this is our round table on the point of doing research into foundations. And I'll ask Dean Rickles from HBAS here in Sydney to kick us off, and then we'll open it up to general discussion from us and yourselves.
You should stand and give this.
Okay, so you may notice that the talk I was going to give has been cancelled. There are, a number of reasons for that. The main one is ARC. Australians will know what that means. Deadlines for grants.
Jim, it might be better if you spoke over there, because then you'll get better with a microphone on the lectern.
Yeah. The other reason is teaching over here. You're expected to prepare way too far in advance for my liking. The other reason, though, is that I thought it was going to be a very easy job, and it turned out not to be quite so easy a job. So Howard Wiseman requested that somebody give an overview talk on these particular philosophy of science issues. So if I can remember rightly, he thought that it would be nice to have a talk on scientific realism and other kinds of realism, what it is to understand phenomena, the relationships between explanation and causality, and whether they can be given a theory-independent definition. The question of what is a theory of everything, what is the hypothetical theory of everything, and the other one was, what's the point of foundations of physics? Which is a very absolute question, I think. The reason why it was so difficult was I thought it would be very easy just to give a quick review of these things, but then maybe Howard knew this when he asked these questions. They turned out to be really, really tightly interwoven. Okay, if you want to talk about the theory of everything, then you've got to talk about understanding, because one of the ideas is that by producing a theory of everything, you're understanding phenomena on all scales, all levels of complexity. That's kind of bound to reductionism. One way of understanding explanation is by reducing something. So it looks like you're giving an explanation. By having a fundamental theory of everything, you can give an explanation of all things and all levels of complexity. Obviously, that's been denied recently, okay, so you probably know Anderson's paper More is Different, where he says that, no, that's not the case. Although we've got reduction going on, okay, although chemistry can be reduced to physics, it doesn't mean that we can reconstitute or reconstruct chemistry from physics. We should view these as autonomous levels. Then that brings the question of realism in, because then you've got a question of, well, are we being realist about the entities at these different levels, or just at the fundamental level? So they turned out to be really tightly bound together. In the end, I'm not so convinced. So Howard thought these would be good questions for foundations of physics people to be told about and understand. In the end, I'm not so sure these questions from philosophy of science have any kind of role to play in foundations of physics research. So I kind of agree with John Wheeler thought about this, and he thought that it should be entirely within physics. Any foundational questions that we discuss about space-time, why the quantum, why the universe, should be discussed entirely within physics and entirely outside of theology and philosophy. And weirdly, being a philosopher, I tend to agree with that. Okay, although it's fine to do foundations of physics, and the questions being dealt with have ramifications for philosophy and possibly theology, I think foundations should be strictly within physics. So on the issue of what is, if we're going to ask what's the point of foundations of physics, we have to know what foundations of physics is, and that's really difficult. There are so many different answers to the question of what foundations of physics is. Some people think it's just philosophy of physics or technical foundations. So in the first issue of the journal Foundations of Physics, Henry Marganow and Jurgrau come up with a list. Okay, the basic definition is that it's just something that deals with fundamental questions, which is really vague. And they give a list of themes like measurement in quantum mechanics, observables, time and space. And then the definition is that foundations of physics should be a clarification of these ideas, a removal of inconsistencies. And the reason why they think we need this is the answer from the editors, is that defects in foundations have been the commonest causes of arrest in scientific development. Now, I don't actually think that's true. I think foundational problems are one of the biggest spurs to scientific development that there is. Generally, we get scientific development when somebody spots a foundational problem. They're not arrests. The other point is that what's weird about foundations questions is that they generally have no bearing on physics, on the actual practice of physics. You can do normal science, as Kuhn calls it, without bothering about foundational questions. Right? For many decades, nobody really cared about the foundational problems of quantum mechanics. They got on fine using quantum mechanics just fine without considering these questions. So anyway, that's the editors of foundations of physics definition. So we should now move on to the question of what the point of foundation of physics is, I suppose. Who better to answer the question than a group devoted to it?
Can I ask one question?
Sure.
Yes, just yes. Yeah. That would be very helpful.
You said that foundations should be done within physics, and you said that foundations of physics may have some repercussions for philosophy. So do you mean to imply then that you think that philosophy has no repercussions for foundations of physics?
But it maybe guides what kind of research avenues we decide to go down. So Einstein had a really peculiar kind of realism. Okay, he viewed it as a stance. Right? It's purely for a philosophical position. And he thought that you should be realist on pragmatic grounds, because it guided research. The knowledge that there might be kind of real entities in your discovery in the world leads to kind of new paths, new bits of research. So it's a kind of heuristic principle rather than anything like that. So philosophy can play a role in how research gets done, but beyond that, I'm not entirely sure. I mean,
well, can I just take issue with one comment I thought I heard you say, but perhaps you didn't, and that is that foundations might not have much impact on physics, physics or normal science.
No, I mean, the question was that physics can go on blithely, blissfully unaware of foundational problems.
Well, I'm not entirely sure that is true, but if it is true, I think one of the ways to orient a foundations research group would be to change that. That these discussions should have an impact on the day-to-day practice of physics. And I think that has happened in the recent past. Certainly some of the things that Julian has dealt with have had a strong impact on quantum optics experiments. Lucian, I must be much more tired than I thought. You feel better? But it's not true in the past either, because general relativity in many ways was a question of reconsidering foundations. After all, there wasn't any particular compelling experimental reason that led Einstein to general relativity. He had no more data than anybody else had. He did have a theory, which special theory of relativity, I suppose. But it was from consideration of what might be considered foundational issues that we have the general theory of relativity.
Well, he had anomalies to work with. There were experimental anomalies.
But I don't think he set out to address those. Yeah.
But they weren't especially guiding in the approach he took, even if he must have been aware of it, but I'm sure he was very happy when he noticed.
He actually wrote down several theories, and then if he didn't get the precession of Mercury right, he tossed it. So there was the Antwerp's theory with the Grossmann, I think.
Oh, yes, of course. No, yeah. He was a physicist first and foremost. There's no doubt about that.
So he had that very fixed in his mind. Give the precession of Mercury right, or he goes out with theory.
Right. But let me just put the suggestion then that for foundational studies to have an impact, there has to be a dialogue between people doing foundational studies and people at perhaps the more speculative ends of phenomenological physics. And I think that's something that this sort of collaboration can do very effectively.
Well, can I ask a question to the philosophers then? Do all the philosophers agree that you know?
No, philosophers never agree.
silly question. What do you think you're doing working in foundations then if it should be wholly within physics? Are you really being a physicist just working in a philosophy department? Or, or are you just doing things for your own amusement?
Well, can I have a go at that? I mean, I think there's a... I hate the question, what is philosophy, and all these sort of those sort of abstract questions about the subject of that kind. But there's a sort of possible view, I don't think it's quite right, but it's got something in it, which is that philosophy isn't a subject at all in its own right. It's a kind of set of skills which can be applied in other subjects, skills to do with things like exploring conceptual structures, getting issues of consistency straight, and a whole bunch of things like that. And there's something to be said for the view that someone who has those skills and is sufficiently motivated by an interest in the problems themselves within some other discipline, physics is just one example, but there are lots of them, so that there's a kind of a sort of activity of philosophy of X, where X is some particular discipline, which involves going in and applying these particular kind of skills, which the people who become philosophers are the ones who are sort of attracted to the use of and good at.
So they're sort of like an academic fire brigade.
Yeah, something
you
like
come
that.
In.
Yeah, I don't. Think, I don't. I think. I think that's. I think there must be better metaphors than that.
Academic rubbish clearing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Clearing out the undergrowth.
Yeah, that's right. Gardeners or something. Like that.
Can I make sure that lights fine?
Can I just correct an impression? When I say I don't mean philosophy doesn't have any role to play in foundations. I mean the questions that were given about realism, causation, explanation, you could give any single answer to those and it wouldn't have any ramification for what's being done in foundations. You could be a realist or an anti-realist. You could give this model of explanation or this one, it wouldn't have any ramifications whatsoever for anything being done in foundations physics. That doesn't mean that philosophy doesn't have any role to play in foundations of physics research. Just that those particular questions that were chosen are irrelevant because...
I don't think I agree with that. I think if you take a certain philosophic stance, let's say you're a physicist, let's say, just use Einstein as the example that you used, take a certain philosophic stance, that helps lead you to the questions that you might study in physics. So you might say, well, with hindsight, it doesn't matter whether he was a realist, so, you know, someone puts forth theory X. With hindsight, you can say, well, it wouldn't have mattered if he were a realist or an anti-realist, because he would have still written down theory X. But I don't think you know that. I think what you can say is that, at least from the guy's own perspective, he's led to various different problems in physics. And the problems he's led to, is probably deeply connected to his whole worldview.
That's true, but it's too subjective. You don't have any control over it. If you see what I mean. You can't say, be a realist, and then you'll discover these great things.
Yeah, it's hard to believe something you don't actually believe.
But it
does lead you.
The better question is, I mean, a bit of it brings, you know, in the time of Einstein and about that time, the sort of conceptual thing and sort of a general philosophical awareness probably did have an impact on the way physics was done, certainly the steps that Einstein made. Since then, or certainly sort of, you know, through the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s, and so on, it's not so clear that was the case. I mean, whilst many of the developments in quantum field theory probably, you know, there was some degree of conceptual thinking going on, largely it was driven just by a kind of very mathematical approach, sort of following through with the mathematical machinery that had been already established earlier. And that might just be the fact that we're in that phase of development of physics, that it wasn't even necessarily a good thing to be overly philosophical. And almost, you know, sociologically, the people who were prepared to just, shut up and calculate sort of were the ones who were successful. But now we have the problem that we're trying to... That probably isn't the case anymore, but probably to make progress in physics, we need to now go back and really tackle these foundational questions. You know, Lee Smolin in his book claims that there's been no development in fundamental physics since, and I forget the year, 1970 something. And that up until that point there was an important development every 15 years or something, I can't remember the numbers, but there hasn't been an important development for quite a while now. And he claims that the reason is that we're not taking on board these foundational issues. So in a sense, we need also a sociological change. If it's the case that now fundamental physics needs to take those issues seriously, then we need to re-establish the importance of foundational thinking in physics. I don't think it's especially, I think it's not a useful division to talk about philosophers and physicists. I think you have just people who have different interests and a whole spectrum. People enter often just because they can get a job in one place or another, rather than because they're fundamentally philosophers or physicists. I don't think that's a useful thing. So I think we need to just have that change where now foundation comes back to the front. I also don't like the idea of foundations as being something that just clears up the mess and sort of sorts out the clutter. I think it's got to be the case that, I mean, if you look at Einstein, really foundational thinking was what led him to write down certain principles, and from those principles he constructed new theories. So it was right at the front of what physics was, and right at the front of where physics was going. And I think that's the correct place for foundations in the current climate.
I would completely agree. In fact, I was meant to be him. I would put it much stronger. I'd put a challenge to people working in foundations to push, let's say quantum mechanics right up against the wall. What are those aspects of quantum mechanics where the cracks will begin to open? Let's find some way to test quantum mechanics to destruction.
So there's a way of thinking about that clearing up the clutter metaphor. If you think of it as it were, clearing away the brambles in order to find what the available paths are, where you think of the paths as being there, that's physical reality.
So this is the brambles in front rather than tweaks of
I think it's a bit of both. It's impediments to seeing the way clearly that you might go forward.
Right.
And I think that's the most useful kind of way to think of what it does when it really contributes something.
Yeah.
Could I ask a question about this internal-external to physics distinction? There is a group of philosophers actually in France what I would call the Finnish school, the Helsinki school, who do claim to be able to say something interesting about the foundations of physics, but from the point of view of logic and the foundations of mathematics, Girard in France and Hindegger and Sandu in Helsinki. So they're definitely working outside physics, and it impresses me that they always take Gödel as a model for this. Gödel, of course, was not a physicist, but he did interest Einstein in closed time loops. So not at all a physicist, but he had something interesting to say about physics. So this seems to suggest that Wheeler's wrong. There's some sort of continuity between certain questions that come up in physics and foundational questions elsewhere in logic and mathematics, and particularly in the development of logic, because these are people, Girard, not only logic but also computation, and Hindegger having to do with the fact that normal classical received logic is just not rich enough to do proper mathematics. So anyway, they both believe firmly, I don't know with what justification, and I never hear physicists, incidentally, discuss this question, that what they say bears on through mathematics, bears on physics. So, yes, my question, is Wheeler right?
Well, I think there is one area of modern physics which is running up against meta-mathematics, if you like, and that's the business of quantum computation and the notion of computability and complexity. Some of the input to quantum computing is coming from computer scientists who do take a rather more abstract, less physical view of what's going on. Perhaps someone more expert than I could comment on that.
On this Wheeler remark, let me just throw something out. I have an unusual memory for John's quotes. And I guess what you're referring to is this one statement that he made, that philosophy is too important to leave to the philosophers.
No, it's not.
I mean, that's a kind of inclusiveness. He was wanting to bring philosophy into physics, but he thought that the philosophers weren't up to the job.
I think that's probably what... you know, I've got the quote written down over there. This is from his biography, you know, Geons, whatever it is, black hole, body.
In space time thing.
Okay. Should I read it? Just for interest? So he says that every morning, whether I'm surveying the ocean from the edge of the cliff at our summer retreat in High Island, Maine, or riding the bus from our home in Hightstown, New Jersey to my Princeton office, I ask myself, how come the quantum, how come the universe, how come existence? With luck, perhaps I'll contribute a little to the answers to these questions in what remains of my life. Not all of my colleagues view these questions quite respectable. But if they are not respectable in the 20th century, they will be in the 21st. They are questions that should be engaging the next generations of physicists. They are questions that should fall, will fall, within physics and will be answered as matters of science, not of philosophy or theology or speculation. So, anyway.
That meshes with it, I think. Philosophy is too important to be left to the philosophers.
Yeah, but we are not going to embark on why existence. We've got some more modest goals, within our PIAF project now.
What are those goals? Modest
I think we're trying to work it out, and I think. Taking up from what you were saying, maybe it's would be best to try and articulate in which areas and in what specific ways foundations is coming to have more importance and potentially more leading role.
Oh, so is coming or should come?
Either or both.
I mean, because one is a passive sort of, oh look, that's what's happening, this is what we should be doing. And I think certainly people working in quantum gravity are increasingly looking to foundational questions for inspiration.
To which side of the strings?
Yeah, I was going to say. Even strange people. You talk to them individually, and maybe I'm biased because I talk to the ones at PI, but they're often very interested in foundational questions. It doesn't show in their talks, but it shows in personal conversations with them. One of the problems, of course, is in both the two major approaches that they've already committed themselves to an approach before they address the foundational question. So they ran so far, then they realized this theory wasn't working, and now they're trying to bring it back to life with quantum foundations, but it's dead from the beginning. And it's better to
Where's the causaloid approach?
Whereas the correct approach, I think, is to insert foundational thinking right from the very beginning, and I think that's something.
I don't think that's true in the case of canonical quantum gravity. I think canonical quantum gravity from the very beginning was dealing with foundational questions like what's the nature of space and time.
Is that true? I thought they'd just say, well, look, here's a canonical formulation of general relativity. Let's quantize it using the mathematical machinery that we have. And then at a certain point, then they had to address foundational questions, but it was too late.
I'm not sure. When Bergman was setting up the canonical formalism, he was explicitly dealing with foundational questions, like what is the nature of observables, how does it relate to symmetries, and these kinds of questions.
Okay.
Thibaut, you wanted to come in.
Yes, I did. And it's probably not a bad time for me to come in, if I may. We're trying to find a role for physicists and philosophers, both in the area of foundations. It occurs to me that science, in its broadest definition, in a very broad formulation, is the pursuit of knowledge about some sort of natural world or about the nature of some sort of physical world. Physics being the physical nature, biology being the biological nature, and chemistry being a chemical, so intermediate scale, But we're talking about the same world at different levels, and we call those science. Perhaps I could say science is the pursuit of knowledge, just use that as a very rough definition. In order to pursue that knowledge, you need some method of thinking. And I would argue that philosophy is the study of that method of thinking, and it provides the toolbox that we would then think about or apply to science and then use it in the pursuit of our knowledge to try and find out what it is we want to know. So philosophy on its own is not going to give you answers to the foundations of physical questions, but it'll tell you perhaps, or it'll help you perhaps formulate how you might go about asking those questions and answering them. And then it's up to the physicists and their empirical interface with the world to try and find out what the answers to those questions are. Maybe a philosopher will be able to tell you what is axiomatic, what the assumptions are in the work that you're doing in your physics. So maybe the philosopher will tell you what the foundations are, but no, won't tell you what the answers are. They'll just tell you which of the foundations that you think are foundations are truly foundational and which are not. And then you as the physicist will then have to go and work out what the answers are and what you want to do with those things. So it's a very good case, I think, for the philosophers and the physicists to sort of get back together again. And I think this is what this forum is about, and I think that's great. For 400 years now, we've had this bifurcation where physics went, well, science went one way, and philosophy went into the metaphysics and went off the other way, and the two didn't talk to each other for 400 years. It's probably about time they got back together again, because each has a contribution. I don't think either can succeed without the other. You do need the philosophers to work out what thinking is, and I think in a sense the mathematicians are philosophers as much as they are scientists. So I think that the mathematics falls almost under the realm of an extrapolation from brute logic that philosophers might work with. So I think that the development of the tools comes from the philosophers. The teaching of those tools to the physicist is perhaps the philosopher's role. And then the physicists are the ones that have to apply those rules to try and work out what the foundations are to their problems, what is foundational and what isn't, and then what the results are going to be, and what assumptions they're making, and then to justify those assumptions. So I think there's a role for both, and I think that it'd be nice to find some sort of complementary role. I can see, even for this collaboration, that there'd be two subcommittees, if you like. There'd be the philosophical subcommittee that would do all the thinking about the thinking, and then there'll be the physicists that would be
the physicists will criticise the thing.
There'll be an interchange between these two groups. Yes. I don't want to separate them, mm-hmm. but I want to say that there are two rather distinct roles that we have to play, and they're quite different kinds of activities. I don't think it's appropriate for physicists to be doing philosophy or philosophers to be doing physics, because they're such different disciplines, they require such different training and such different mindsets that I don't think I could do both, and I don't know many people who can do both effectively. But there is a very good argument for having each half and then each half talking to the other half, working together to get an outcome that neither half would be able to do on its own.
I disagree with this idea of partitioning people into physicists and philosophers, because there are so many people in the intersection. Like David Wallace, for example, he's a very good. He has a PhD in physics. He's completing. Has a position in the philosophy department, and he's doing a PhD in philosophy. Michael Redhead, brilliant, both. And the list is long. I don't want to embarrass people here. I think people are capable of doing both things, regardless of whether they're in a physics or a philosophy department. I mean, of course, there are certain types. There are certain types of philosophy that maybe are sufficiently far from physics that it might be difficult for those philosophers a long way from physics to engage directly in physics. But I think philosophers of the sort that I've mentioned could quite easily engage in building new physical theories and the sort of foundational work that I think is required at the forefront of development of physics.
Murray Gell-Mann once had a dinner with Niels Bohr, mm-hmm. and he wrote this in one of his books, and he mentions it, and he said, Professor Bohr, you're the champion of the theory of complementarity. What do you think is the complementarity of truth? And without even hesitating, Niels Bohr said, clarity. And I think that's the point. Where the philosophers are going to try and achieve clarity, while I've got my philosopher's hat on and I'm thinking in a certain way, then I can't really be doing physics at the same time. While I've got my physicist's hat on, then it's going to be difficult for me doing philosophy at the same time. I don't want to divide people and say, no, this person should be on that committee, that person should be on that committee. But I think functionally the two bifurcate. There's a kind of way that we do philosophy, there's a kind of way we do physics, and there's a kind of way we use one toolbox in the other, and the way we apply the other in the first. So there's a kind of role play that we have to do, and that's why I think we should think about the two separately and how we can use both, but distinguish between different kinds of disciplines.
I was just going to say that I'm an experimentalist, and I would spend about 20% of my time at least doing conceptual clarification. So I don't see how to line that up with what you just said.
The bifurcation, I mean, to some extent, it's a sort of research sociology that tends to force the difference. I'd be interested to know, when you, if you were to apply to the AIC for a grant to fund foundations research, which committee would it go to?
Well, I think that's a sort of practical issue. I don't know about your research office, but we always get the advice to make sure it only goes to one committee and doesn't get split between two.
Oh, sure, absolutely. But which would you choose?
Well, I think it would depend on where you're back. Yeah, it depends on your background. So you guys would apply to physics and we'd apply to philosophy.
Or on the emphasis of the subject, yeah. I guess. Mm.
And what about in Canada, for example, or the UK, likewise?
We work at PI.
Money, what's money?
Ask Michael Duchesne, he also does.
Republic, I
think. Yeah, I mean, at PI, you don't have a problem of money, and in the UK, there is no money.
Actually, Rob might know. Do you know how the Canadian funding system works with respect to foundations? You don't know either.
I don't think it does.
No, I think it's an important issue for this collaboration. At some point, it would be nice to see a joint research project funded by the ARC.
I think
what happened if it came to the Physics Chemistry Committee.
In some sense, it just has to be sufficiently big, so that the fact that it's got these sort of a foot in each camp becomes a virtue rather than a vice.
I see. So it's taken out and funded nationally as a major issue.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Robin.
So a while back, Dean read this quote by John Wheeler about things that were questions, were going to be questions of physics, and Chris responded by abbreviating that as philosophy is too important to be left to the philosophers. It seemed to me that one might also have interpreted it as physics is too important to be left to the philosophers. And I'm wondering about a question we've danced around a bit, which is not whether a given person is being a physicist or being a philosopher, but is a given question physics or philosophy? Is there a matter of fact for any given question as to which it is? And if your answer is yes, then what about the question of whether time is absolute in the year 1900?
I mean, part of my bracketing the realism, anti-realism stuff from physics was precisely because you can see clearly there that you could give either answer to that and it would have no impact on the physics. So it's philosophy. Whereas questions about space, time and whatnot, they kind of would have an impact on the physics. Relational theories are very different to construct from absolute theories. You've just got to look at kind of Barbara Batot, the kind of acrobatics that you have to do to get a relational theory of mechanics. They do have an impact on physics. So they can, but they're not just physics or just philosophy, those particular questions, I don't think. Whereas the realism, anti-realism one, that's just philosophy. I don't know, does that kind of answer you?
So it's philosophy only if it has no impact on physics by definition?
I haven't really thought that out properly, but it sounds like a reasonable criterion.
Here's an example of how realism versus anti-realism might have an impact on physics. So if you're a realist, you might tend to sort of develop something like the De Broglie-Bohm model. And then once you develop that model, you might notice that if you have non-equilibrium distributions, so this distribution is not equal to psi squared, you get different physics.
But not
then you might go out and test it. You might turn out you're right.
But not necessarily, and you wouldn't.
No, but that's a possible sequence of events. So there would be an example of how committing yourself to realism versus.
But you could be an anti-realist and do the same thing.
I don't see how an anti-realist would.
He wouldn't have the same compulsion to work on those problems.
I mean, it's conceivable that anti-realists would write down the same equations and not interpret them the same way, but I just don't see how that could happen.
That's why I said with hindsight. With hindsight, you can justify any of these moves from any philosophical stance. But if you're living in the moment, you're a physicist and you have one kind of philosophy, like take Antony Valentini, he's an extreme realist. He wouldn't consider all of this crap about Bayesian probabilities. He wouldn't look for coherence conditions within quantum mechanics. Those are just not a set of questions that are alive for him. But a set of questions that are alive for him is whether there is this pilot wave equation or that pilot wave equation, and whether these two distinct possibilities can be distinguished by experiment. It's this philosophy that's driving him. Similarly, it was a philosophy that was driving David Deutsch. He had an extreme realist philosophy about what quantum mechanics should be saying, and he had a predisposition for yes. And you know, this pushed him toward looking at whether one could see something with a quantum computer that one can't see classically. So it was a philosophy that pushed that. And I think in the case of Einstein, I don't know him very well, but I think it's pretty clear that he studied Mach earlier than the formation of general relativity.
Well, he's an interesting case because he started off as an anti-realist and then became a realist.
Yeah, but it's easy to see the anti-realism as just a kind of motivational thing, which kind of freed him up so he could see which bits were really doing some work and which bits he could leave out in modifying classical mechanics.
All of Chris's examples are really sort of motivational things. Yeah. I mean, physics is an experimental science. If you're doing something that's connecting with experiments and you're doing physics, the motivation is coming from a philosophy that maybe you'd say that's coming from outside, and as soon as it becomes something that's testable, and you're doing physics. I mean, this sort of connects with what Jared was saying before, you know, as, you know, when would we say we're doing physics? I mean, the benchmark we would be held against, I think, here is this something that, even if it's not doing experiments, is it going to lead to something that people are going to experiment on? Is it testable?
Changing
if it fails on that regard, then it'll fail as a physics application.
No, Steve, you had your hand up a while ago.
It was really just to mention Mach. I was surprised to hear you say that you thought that the debate about the nature of time in 1900 might not have had any sort of physical valence. I mean, I think that this is the kind of thing that Einstein was thinking about whether time is absolute, whether it's defined relative to other objects. I mean, he operated, special relativity came out of an operationalization of the notion of simultaneity. So, but this is almost what was just said. I mean, I think what just occurs to me that the sort of a classic example of the kind of work that you would like to see in foundations is the work of Bell, right? He's a physicist. It's not clear whether what he was doing is physics or philosophy. It certainly involves a pretty strong conceptual analysis. If you have a philosopher doing that, great. If you have a physicist like Bell doing it sort of as a part-time job when he's not doing high-energy physics, that's fine too. That's the kind of work that we'll support.
That's right. And it had a direct impact on the experimental agenda. He tried to. He could have pushed quantum mechanics to the breaking point, as happens. It hasn't turned out quite that way, at least not yet. Yeah, that's a very nice example.
Now, let's see. Owen, you have your hand up.
Okay. I kind of want to make just maybe an observation about thinking about things and trying to reformulate things that doesn't necessarily, it's not immediately apparent what that actually gives you. And then sort of in the 19th century, people tried to reformulate classical mechanics in a whole bunch of different ways, and they are very often motivated by certain principles and ideas. And there was no question that this was actually going to lead to different empirical results, but you just have to sort of mention that Lagrange and Hamilton's reformulation of classical mechanics, if that hadn't taken place, it's hard to see how a lot of 20th century physicists would have happened. And yet at the same time, there was no question that was actually that Hamilton-Lagrange mechanics was actually going to produce different experimental results. But it turned out to be actually extremely important that happened.
But I mean, it's kind of the thing that bothers me about this, and what you were saying about the stance that they held kind of pushed them towards things. That could be anything. They, Einstein could have eaten a banana for breakfast and seen that it was curved and got it that way, and it would have had the same effect.
I think that's less like.
I don't believe that. I think there was some. I mean, there was something about the approach he was taking. I mean, that was correct in some sense. I mean, it was a good approach to take.
On the other hand, I agree with you that with any position in philosophy on these questions is compatible with doing this or that kind of research, and that means that somehow to return to the theme of the round table, these motivational aspects, these aspects of stance, that's not the reason why philosophers do foundations of physics. I mean, it's not developing some realist position is not the thing that may have an immediate impact on physics research. May have a distal impact, or William James has a distal impact on Chris Fuchs.
What does distal mean?
Distant.
Yeah, I mean, not an indirect or
as opposed to proximal.
But we wouldn't say that doing that kind of working on that kind of philosophical problems has a direct relevance to foundations. It is useful to focus on an example like Bell. That's the kind of work which could have been done in a philosophy department. Wasn't, but which is unfortunate for right applications.
Rob, you have your hand up.
Well, so first of all, I just wanted to add sort of another voice of support dissent that I'm hearing in a few places, which is that the objective of foundations of physics really isn't that different from normal physics, that the hope is to make progress to eventually come up with new physics, make new discoveries. That seems to me to be the right objective to have, but it's done in a way where the tools of philosophers are very useful, and so I would agree with Hugh that insofar as foundations of physics is concerned, I see the field of philosophy as a set of skills that are very useful at making progress in the sorts of difficult conceptual problems that foundations of physics deals with. And so now I just wanted to ask a practical question. So my experience has been that several people in foundations of physics have both sets of skills, and sometimes they've acquired it on their own, but other times they've acquired it because they went through some sort of program where they were trained as a physicist and as a philosopher. So one example that comes to mind is an Oxford program in physics and philosophy. And I had a similar sort of experience in my undergrad, which is very useful. And so the practical question is, we have this great partnership. Is there any opportunity for a young undergrad in Australia who's very interested in doing foundations, interested in physics, interested in philosophy? What can we do for them? Is there some sort of joint program that could be set up? What could you offer such a person?
Yeah, that's an interesting question.
Yeah, I mean the objective, the ultimate objective of this body is to make it possible for someone to pursue a career in foundations. Which means, all the way through. It's not just,
sure.
So it is something we want to address. We haven't addressed it currently.
It's probably there is a demand for it. I've been teaching a second year subject jointly with the philosophy department for 6 years now, but it leads to nowhere. It just sits there. My physics colleagues tried to hide it for many years by not putting it in the handbook. Finally got rid of all those people. Now it's in the handbook. But if that was part of some national program, Well, I'm not quite sure how to put it, or if we had the occasional guest speaker come in from PR to that class, that would be quite inspirational. In fact, one of the things that I find has happened in foundational studies over the last 20 years is that the average age of the audience in meetings like this has got lower, and which I find very heartening indeed.
It's not just a relative observation. I've noticed that one.
This is why we need philosophers, you see. I always clarify our language.
John?
I just wanted to say something about one of the problems, I think is a real problem of the late 20th century, is the compartmentalization of things into being you're either a physicist or a philosopher or a mathematician. So I'm surprised that no one mentions mathematicians. Take Riemann's wonderful discussion on the foundations of geometry, behind which we get other people can use as a tool if you think of things being able to be used as a tool. I think the really interesting why it's here, I think also it's very interesting, I find with students, especially the young students, even though I teach in the maths department, or taught in the maths department, they would be interested if you tell them about problems in physics or foundational problems in physics and how mathematics plays a role in that. And I think very often you would get people who would come up to you and want to know, where can I know more about this? How can I do more study in this sort of thing? And I think it's a great idea to try to enlarge our view and to bring in many more young people with lots of different ideas. And the other thing I wanted to say is that we have to. Is there a subject called the Foundations of Philosophy? There is a subject called the Foundations of Mathematics, but that I remember reading a wonderful paper called "Wither the Foundations," which was with an ambiguous spelling of the wither. And the point was that there was an analogy they made with some castles which were built along the Rhine River, where there were these spiders down the basement who were making beautiful webs of the most intricate patterns joining together the various stones. They thought that they were holding the castle together. They were the foundations. Well, in fact, and I think this is true. Physicists can and mathematicians will go on working in their subject, maybe not knowing much about the foundations, but every now and then it's extremely important. And I applaud the sort of ideas that you're suggesting for the future.
There was a question earlier. Yes, please.
I just have a very vague and slightly poetic kind of question. So, obviously, directed towards the philosophers.
Naturally,
so, first, I'd just like to quote Einstein. So, someone asked him during one of the tests of general relativity, I think, the one where they were testing the bending of light by the gravitational field, that what you have thought or said, has the test gone wrong? And Einstein replied that, I pity the Lord because the theory is correct. So there have been a number of physicists who've been really convinced or who've had a strong conviction about conviction that physical theories should be simple and elegant. So my question is, how important are the virtues of elegance and simplicity in constructing physical theories? And if they are important, why is it so? What's the basis of this kind of conviction?
Now, I know Dirac said it was the most important aspect of an equation of a theory that it has to be beautiful. I don't know why though.
It's probably coming out with beautiful
ones. Yeah. I would guess it's genetic. Because I look at the women that I'm attracted to. And similarly, no, this is only a joke, only a slight joke.
Definitely in the wrong direction.
But, no, seriously, there's a certain, one has to have a certain attraction to a theory or a structure to pursue thinking about it. I mean, I just think of this stupid little example from last week. There was a little equation that I showed Lucy and I showed Rob today, and I've just been staring at this equation for 2 weeks. And for no real reason, it's not like a great thought has come into my head, but it just looks very pretty.
Is there medication?
And so I keep staring at it simply because it looks very pretty. So You know, just like one pursues a nice looking house, you want to buy the house.
Oh, but it has,
similarly with theories, I would guess.
Yeah, but it has. So the question is that coincidentally, it has also turned out that our greatest theories are in fact elegant and simple.
Well, because they're the ones. That's a selection effect.
Yeah, just because we've forgotten all the elegant, beautiful theories that were completely wrong. Just remember those.
Yeah, they were probably quite beautiful to their.
I'm sure they were.
To their founders.
We don't remember their founders either.
What makes something beautiful is the philosophy that you bring to it.
There's also an economy, isn't there? I mean, to some extent, the beauty is in the simplicity and how far you can get with a given theory. That is a fairly simple set of principles, like special relativity. You get a lot of mileage, and there's a certain elegance and beauty in that, and I think there's probably a good algorithmic information explanation of that phenomenon.
There's another principle which I think is more important, when you were at the conference in Iceland, because this question came up there, you know, with simplicity and beauty as two driving principles. And I think there's another possibility which we take seriously, which is that a theory should be very funny. and this is serious. The reason for that is there's something about the structure of a joke which we also expect in the structure of a great new principle, a great new idea. So a joke is, you know, blah 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 blah, surprise. Okay. And a great new principle in physics is, you know, blah blah blah. Oh my god, I didn't think of looking at it in that way. Yeah, surprise. And there's something about having a new novel insight that no one had thought of before, which I think is just funny.
Particularly if it's a simple surprise.
I think just yeah.
The equivalent of a bad joke makes you groan.
That's anybody who's taught physics knows that.
Yeah. I should just one more thing I'd like to mention, you very briefly hinted to it, namely the significance of working foundations of physics for philosophy. I think that it's just good to mention it, even if, you know, most people here are physicists, that there is a lot of value, although it's not always recognized by fellow philosophers, in doing foundations of physics, because that feeds directly, can feed directly into clarifying questions in philosophy about, say, in particular, say, causation or meaning of probability, lots of things which, you know, philosophers do think about, and in my opinion, very risky to think about if you don't know how these things work in physics, particularly foundations of quantum mechanics, I find is a source of counterexamples for any grand claim you make about, you know, how physics and the world works.
I second that.
Yeah, which is why Abner Shimony has, you know, Abner Shimony has a really nice phrase for this: experimental metaphysics. It's kind of a check on our metaphysical views that we have in philosophy. It's a way to think about it.
Yeah, I've seen sort of philosophers who weren't informed about physics sort of, you know, say things that just wouldn't, like, for example, you know, a long discussion of teleportation. In the absence of understanding of quantum theory, really, you miss a lot of the point. You know, that there isn't a problem in teleportation of cloning, so those are sort of rising. And I'm sure there are many classes. So someone said earlier that, I think it was it Joshua, that one great example of quantum foundations is Bell, the Bell's theorem. And so I want to sort of slightly disagree with that. I think Bohm was better I think Bohm was a better quantum foundations worker than John Bell, not just because he was more committed to it, but I think in a sense we've been, I mean, of course Bell's work was fantastic, but there's this, we've been slightly, we're slightly overawed in the field of quantum foundations by Bell's theorem and Bell's approach and the way Bell did things. You know, so the idea of experimental metaphysics, which I think is great, and testing things against principles, I think that's all great, but I think it's much better to actually construct new theories, and I think that's what Bohm tried to do. He actually tried to construct something, and ultimately, progress in physics is about actually constructing new theories. And of course, you may gain insight from the kinds of things that Bell did along the way. But you know, an analogy is, you know, if you want to build a house and you have a pile of bricks. We had a lot of time looking at the bricks and sort of commenting on the shape of the bricks and how beautiful they are, and you know, how, if you hold them up to the sun, where they shine and so on. But in the end, if you want to build a house with those bricks, you've got to just sort of get down to it and build the house with those bricks. And that's how you build a house with bricks. I think we need some of that attitude in quantum foundations.
Well, right, but what it is, I mean, that was kind of, you wouldn't take that attitude toward building a bridge. I mean, if you build a suspension bridge, you really need to understand something about
it. No, but I would. I mean,
the materials and the structure.
But there's a certain point at which you have to start building the suspension bridge.
And keep your fingers crossed that you can walk over it.
So maybe it's a matter of the difficulty of the task as well. So maybe experimental metaphysics is useful just because the task ahead is quite hard. So maybe the best we do now is try to think of what going against is not. And that's what Bell's theorem tells you, and which might give you insight of what it is. With the bridge, you don't need too much insight about the bricks. It's easy to just go get off the job. With the bridge, you might need some more insight. So it depends on the task that you have, and that decides whether or not preliminary task is useful or not.
Well, I mean, yeah, but in the end, you do need to still do it. I mean, it's interesting that Bell was completely motivated by Bohm. Just to sort of, so you know, there's a lot of value in theory construction.
We're going to have to wind up soon. So I was just, something occurred to me when Bell was mentioned before, and it's occurred to me now that Bohm has been mentioned as well. I mean, I've heard it said by, I think, people interested in foundations in physics that, you know, if you go back 30 years, there wasn't the kind of community of both physicists and philosophers interested in the foundational issues. So it's interesting to kind of, if that's true, I'm not sure to what extent it is true, it's interesting to speculate what it kind of would have been like for Bohm and Bell if they'd been living at a time when the foundational issues were taken much more seriously. I think this connects with what you said earlier, Lucien, about how there was this long period in which the productive thing to do actually turned out to be to ignore those issues and just get shut up and calculate.
Well, what do you think would have changed?
I don't know.
Maybe they wouldn't have done anything because they thought there's a community out there working on it. But that's not what you mean.
No. What I suspect is true is that they would have got a lot further because they would have got a lot more
feedback.
Well, we know that Bohm was very interested in talking philosophy at all stages of his life. Mm-hmm. If you could name a physicist that took philosophy seriously, it would be Bohm. His philosophical conclusions are not widely appreciated by philosophers.
Okay, well, we have to wind up, and we have some drinks and refreshments waiting for us over in the old villa next door, I hope. Should we go over and enjoy those? And most of you, I know, will be here tomorrow. We start tomorrow at the same time, 9:30 or something?
9:30, yes.
So there'll be coffee here again from about 9 o'clock. So thank you all for coming.
Thank you.